But hi. So yes, my name is Lauren Langworthy. I am the Director of Special Projects at Wisconsin Farmers Union, and we are gathered here today to talk about cooperatives. And we have a fun panel of people assembled. I'm going to let them introduce themselves, but we were just chatting a little bit right before we got started about some of our goals for this session, and I think one of our big goals is to understand what all you want to get out of the session and make sure that we're having those kinds of conversations. So I have, I think, five questions to kind of prime the pump, get us started, get us talking, help you know who the people up here are and what kind of expertise they're bringing into this conversation. And then I'm really hoping that you all will come up with some questions to help us make this an engaging opportunity for everybody to walk away feeling like you know something that you wanted to know. So that said, I'm just going to start right here with Kelly, who happens to be to my right, and let everyone do like a two-minute or less introduction of yourself, and then we'll get started with some questions.
Okay. All right, it's working. So Kelly Maynard, I'm a cooperative development specialist at the University of Wisconsin Center for Cooperatives. And I'll just, real quick, so the center has been around 60 years now, and we are one of 30-some co-op development centers around the country that do a lot of different things, but one of the main things we do is help people start co-ops and do co-op education and training. And when people ask me what does it mean to be a co-op development specialist, one of our colleagues jokes that really what I am is a co-op doula and therapist. Is more accurate description of a lot of my day-to-day. Co-ops are really hard things to birth, and I coach people through that process. And then because they are projects that involve more than one person, there's always a lot of interpersonal stuff and involves a lot to sort through. So I tend to focus on food and agricultural co-ops because we are a center in Wisconsin. I mostly work in Wisconsin, but I have worked beyond Wisconsin, and our center works on some things in the upper Midwest and across the country. And I think one thing I'll say that has been really exciting, I think we were seeing some uptick already, but we have had an inundation of requests for people interested in maybe starting a co-op with COVID. And so, you know, not all of those come to fruition, but I think we are seeing a lot of people with really innovative ideas, people kind of turning the co-op model on its head, thinking about doing things differently. And so it's been really fun. It's been kind of overwhelming to try to support a lot of these projects, but also fun to see all the ideas that people have. So I'm excited to see if people here have ideas too. So.
I'm Austin Frerick. I'm Austin Burke. I am a fellow at Thurman Arnold Project at Yale. It's basically an antitrust center. Our job is to help convene students to talk about the concentration in American markets and what to do about it. A lot of what the organization does is focus on big tech, but big ag is kind of my focus, my passion. I'm an Iowa native. There's an Easter Rapids people out there. But yeah, so that's a lot of my goal is, I mean, from a job side, it's just teaching these skills. How do you hosting conferences, inviting people to come speak, and just raising awareness and helping this big shift we're seeing in America of how we talked about monopoly. And that's what I'm working on a book now, and that's what I talked about earlier today.
And I'm Josh Bryson at Turner Brock Farm. We're in Clear Lake, Wisconsin. We have 180 members, CSA, in the Hans Farm and Creamery, where we milk 12 cows, rotational graze, and this is year 15, I think, of operating corn. And prior to that, I was managing other farms that were working with the limited farmer population and trying to organize people like that, but I've also been involved with three other co-ops, two of which I was on the board, and one that I was just sort of a producer for. So hope I can lend some experience to that angle of this conversation.
I'm Ken Meter with Crossroads Resource Center in Minneapolis. My first credentials. I'm a member of CSA member of Turnip Rock Farm. I'm a member of Wisconsin Farmers Union. And my co-op development practice actually was in the 1970s, starting some co-ops in urban Minneapolis to try to provide low-cost services to people who lived in a low-income community. That was a mixed experience, but it was a rich one. And after that, I had a career in journalism as an independent journalist covering the farm crisis of the 1980s. And at the point where the editors told me the story before I got started writing the story, I decided it was time to move into something else. And I've now been, in the last 20, 25 years, been focusing on the economics of farm and food systems, worked in 41 states around the country. And I'm also leaving here at 6:30 to sign my book, Building Community Food Webs, which is down at the bookstore.
And I'm realizing that I made a terrible faux pas of not explaining that Wisconsin Farmers Union, despite being called a union, is actually a cooperative.
Yep.
Oh, really? There you go.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe not everybody knew that, so I'm glad I mentioned it. And three of the areas that we use as kind of our mission orientation, we put them in a triangle and talk about them that way, are cooperation, education, and legislation. That's how we see building power. And so cooperation can be the cooperative model. It can also be larger collaboratives, but I should have started with that, and I did not. So anyway, I'm going to pitch a couple of questions to these folks. I'm going to make one person start and hope that they talk about it a little bit. And then we're just going to kind of work through a handful of questions that I have, and I hope that you're all thinking, especially those of you who wandered in a little bit late, about the questions that you have, because we're going to be looking to you to keep this conversation rolling beyond that. So the first question I have, I'm actually going to pitch to Josh. You ready for this? So what interests you in the cooperative model, and what issues do you see it possibly addressing?
I think as a producer, I was interested in the cooperative model mostly from the perspective of relieving some of the burden of direct marketing and sort of having an infrastructure to feed into that that could take... free up some of my time, I guess is the best way to put it. But I think after my experience with them over the years, I see it to be a challenge in actually achieving that goal. And I think now my interest is more in not so much formal cooperatives, but how our community of farmers in our area can cooperate together around collective advocacy. So how we can let our presence be known to our community, how we can say the impact that we have both economically and socially in our community. I think those things are really important, and I think they're probably more important than replicating what the industrial food system has already done. Because I think once we start to replicate the models of the industrial food system, we are already at a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. We don't have the capital, we don't have the production scale, we don't have the economies of scale, so we're always playing catch up, and I think in the end, it hurts more to do that than to just continue on our own direct marketing path and have our own nimbleness of our businesses as farmers, and being able to continue to go in the direction that we need to go individually and not be tied to a cooperative that needs a lot of funding to get off the ground.
What are some other ideas on that subject? What issues can the cooperative model address, or what draws you to them?
I mean, I just say this as a buyer. I mean, I hate the term consumer, but it's trust is like what I get out of it is I know, I mean, just the concrete example I think about all the time is organic milk. I don't trust Horizons, but I trust Organic Valley. I think the labeling, I mean, we can critique it all day of USDA really failing its job on what labels mean in America. But I know with cooperative, because of the structure, like, yes, something can mimic corporate, like that, the model they're kind of not. But there is some democratic component to it where I know, you know, I'm not getting some, you know what I mean? It's like when you see a certain pork and it says all natural and you're like, what does that mean? I think it helps on a trust side.
One thing that I'm seeing that is, and I agree that like small scale farmers trying to start like a traditional marketing co-op is really hard. But there are folks that are, you know, producers and folks in, you know, outside of ag sector that are using the co-op model to fill needs that support their farming operations. So I think of an example in Minnesota where a group of farmers started a healthcare cooperative to provide healthcare plan for farmers. And it was a long, effort. It involved changes in legislation. It was a big effort, right? But now there is a farmer-owned healthcare plan in Minnesota. There are folks that I know now who are thinking about, you know, cooperatively owned land as a way to like access land when, you know, prices are high, and doing that individually feels insurmountable. There are folks who are, you know, I am working with two projects now where they're both producer and worker owned, so like a hybrid or multi-stakeholder model, and like honoring that. And one of them is trying to do meat processing. One is has a prepared meal subscription program, but they're honoring this like labor challenge, right? And like if you bring labor in on the ground floor, and they, it's like they haven't solved it, right? It's like still a challenge. But if you bring labor in on the ground floor as an owner in a business, does that help with the fact that like finding labor is so hard right now? You know, there are folks, you know, not just farmers, but folks, you know, forming childcare co-ops, right? So I think that there's roles for co-ops to play that are not just that support farmer livelihoods that are not just about marketing produce, but meet needs that are surround the, you know, the farm business and having a family and a life.
I think what I'd add to this conversation is that, you know, I had a chance to interview some of the farmers in one of the co-ops that Josh mentioned, and I think the interesting dynamic that I saw in that was that by adopting a model of exporting food to the Twin Cities, it was very easy for the community, surrounding community, to think of you as hippies or think of you as others. And now that you're talking about really building connections, collaborations and connections with your neighbors, you have a much richer conversation, and you're starting to get a conversation about how are we like each other and how does our farm really help the community move forward. And that creates a whole different energy and a whole different set of possibilities.
All right, awesome. There we go. We got rolling. Question number one under our belts. All right. Question number two is around how can the cooperative model serve to shift local economies specifically? As we think about our rural communities, our farming communities specifically maybe, or our food systems, local food systems, how are cooperatives different on that really local scale? Oh, and I'm going to send that one to Ken.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, I should have started there.
Thanks for the warning. Well, I mean, I think, you know, first of all, I think in Wisconsin and Minnesota, we have a pretty strong cooperative culture to work on. And that goes back to the 1970s, it goes back to the 1930s, and it goes back to the 1890s in Europe. It often goes to some specific countries like parts of Scandinavia, Central Europe, immigrants who came over who understood that cooperating was something really important to do, and they brought that culture with them, and it sort of survived, but very, very episodically, ups and downs, and a lot of that is, you know, grandparents pass it on to their grandchildren, and it kind of keeps carrying forward. But as when the economy gets more prosperous, people tend to want to fight on their own, and when things get really miserable, cooperatives flourish because it's the only thing we really have left. So that's an unfortunate thing about it, but I'm working in several places where you cannot talk about cooperatives. There's no heritage there. There's no one who really understands that, and there's no kind of support framework of saying, oh yeah, we can sit down together and make these decisions. There's a great co-op here, you know, in Southwest Wisconsin, the Fifth Season Co-op, where, you know, the farmers originally started to talk about how they could market their produce to metro markets. And in the course of that conversation, they realized they had to have more control over the marketing than just simply sending stuff off in a truck and hoping the price would be there when it got to Chicago or Minneapolis. So they had a very clever idea of inviting the food service director for the hospital to join the board of the farmers co-op. And then the food service director of the hospital had a squash partner who happens to own Reinhardt Produce, which delivers a lot of the produce for this conference, right out of here, right here out of La Crosse. And so you have these unusual collaborations that happen with private businesses that are part of a, now part of a cooperative, which again, that's not perfect. It's had some rough edges, but also that allows the broader community kind of, you know, a three-year conversation about how do we form this cooperative in a way that'll be righteous for everybody. And that's a very different way to approach how you do this than sort of saying the classic co-op model or certainly the private business model.
I mean, to me, it's just a simple thing of you're circulating your money locally. I mean, so much of rural America at this point, and it's a hard term to use, but it's basically an extraction colony. You have, I mean, the bank now as well as Fargo. It's a Dollar General. It's a Casey's. The hospital's been consolidated. What capital are people earning that they're spending that is staying circulated in their community? It's not. It's going to ex-urban area. So at least with the co-op, even in a farm way or in an off, like we were mentioning earlier, non- kind of the wraparound stuff, at least you're trying to like keep your money locally instead of having it be sucked out to some other city. I mean, so much lost, we talk about inequality as a society, but what's lost in this is inequality between communities and between cities. So for like every, I'm trying to think of a, for every Austin, Texas, there's a St. Louis, Missouri. And you look at St. Louis, Missouri, and that's because all the capital, all the big businesses got consolidated out. So that to me is the way I look at it too.
Yeah, I'm just giving it a minute to soak if anyone has any other thoughts. Otherwise, we can move on. Yeah, they're interesting questions to think about food systems specifically, but I also appreciated what Kelly was bringing up around some of the other ways in which we can use cooperatives because people don't always think of them that way.
One thing that I'll say that's economy adjacent is that I don't work. I'm kind of new to the worker co-op world because that's somewhat new in like the food and agriculture space. But our center, some colleagues of mine support a lot of different worker co-ops, which a worker co-op can be in literally any sector in the economy that can have, you know, five or so employees could be a worker co-op. And folks who never imagine themselves to be owners of businesses or on a board or anything like that. And co-ops are hard, and learning to like govern a business with a group of people is hard. And there are folks who've taken that experience to get involved in local government, right? It's been super empowering for them. And they, you know, like, I can run for my town board. I can run for county this. I know how to be, you know, govern a thing, right? And those people in local government are involved in decisions that impact local economies. And so I think that there's learning that happens in being part of a cooperative enterprise, even if your cooperative enterprise isn't ultimately successful, but that's applicable in these other spheres where there's influence.
Yeah, I love that. I love the idea of having more people running for boards and participating in those types of leadership. I think we often have this like kind of distant view of what leadership looks like. But I joined the Wisconsin Farmers Union board, which has been a very informative experience once upon a time, you know, to sit in those meetings and learn that process and think about how we make cooperative decisions and for the good of a larger mission. It's a fascinating process, and there's a lot to take from it. And I want to take a moment, too, because I think a lot of the people in the room here are probably interested in cooperatives. That's probably why you came to this session. And I think often when we talk about co-ops, we get a little rosy-eyed, especially people who are new to the concept of cooperatives. It's like, oh, the idea that we can just all band together and we can make something better, like we're stronger together. And that is a piece of the cooperative model. And Kelly alluded to this earlier, so I'm going to start the question with her. But there are some challenges too in the cooperative model with people and business and equity and so what are some of the challenges that you often see people running into or that you think are bigger barriers as people get into this?
I mean, I think that there are some structural things, right? Like it's in co-ops in small scale ag, like it's hard to access capital, it's hard, there are things out there. I also think that particularly in this country, white culture in this country, we're raised in this super individualist oriented way. You know, when I think about the kind of education that I provide now to co-ops, none of it is anything I learned in school, like kindergarten through master's, right? It's all been in, like, because I sought education in, like, facilitation, how to run an effective meeting, how to move a group through conflict. And so I think that there's, when a group of people come together with a cooperative idea, the thing that they're excited about is whatever the cooperative idea is, naturally. They're like, we need, you know, our businesses need this, you know, our farms need this thing, our, you know, whatever. We are so jazzed about trying to get this thing going. And you need a lot of energy and you know, commitment to that business idea. but you have to be prepared to devote a significant amount of time to just what does it mean to be in business as a group? Right? Like, what does it mean, this democratic association concept? What are our rules? How are we writing things down? How are we running meetings? Are we doing Robert's Rules of Order? Are we doing policy governance or sociocracy? There's this stuff that's hard to talk about that we don't get formal education on, and it's not necessarily at all tied to the business idea that you were excited about that brought you together. But it's like it needs attention, and the thing, you know, particularly when I'm working with farmers, producers, right? Like, time is what people don't have a lot of, and so having the time to commit to all these pieces of getting a co-op going is so hard. And I see people burn out as much as anything because learning all of these pieces takes a lot of time. And the thing that's easy to shortchange is the soft, squishy stuff about how the group process and all of this, and that's where it can really break down. And there's not, you know, just because you have a big conflict or something, it's not like you can't work through it. But that's where groups of people and co-ops that really commit to education in that arena on an ongoing basis, like forever, you've never learned all you can learn about being, you know, working in a group, making decisions in a group, they don't get us in their own way as much. I'll leave it at that for now.
Yeah, and there's so much potential for things to get personal when things are tough, right? And I'm curious to hear Josh's thoughts too, because you specifically mentioned an interest in starting a co-op because you didn't have time. Right?
Yeah.
So to respond to Kelly,
do
you want to share any thoughts about that?
That's exactly the rosy-eyed, this is really going to help my business. And, you know, but then you realize over time that, there's a lot of commitments that you have to engage in. And not only that, the people that are at your table, you're relying on them too, right? So you've hitched your wagon to their wagon, and now you're all pulling together. But if somebody says, oh, I'm going through a divorce, I'm out. And then somebody says, oh, this is too much, I can't do this. Or I can only do it at this level. And now all of a sudden you're starting to look at the picture and go, well, wait, this isn't really, we're actually putting in a lot of effort for something that's not a lot of gain. And in the individualistic society, you also really just have that, well, what's in it for me? You just ask that question every time you go into that room. So, and that's a hard equation when all of your time is consumed and you're trying to do something, pay people wages and do all the things that you got to do as a business. And then you feel like you're wasting your time. So where I've come to is that, reality is that if you're doing a CSA or you have relationships with other farmers that you're collaborating with on some level, that's enough. That's cooperation, you know what I mean? We don't have to be formal about it, but sharing risk, sharing reward, that's what cooperation is. And don't sell yourself short on those things, because they're probably more important and more sustainable than more of the formal format of cooperatives.
And I want to pitch a kind of side question to Ken, too, mentioning risk and reward. Thinking of it from an economist standpoint, there is equity that has to go into starting a co-op, right? People have to put something forward to make this thing come to life, the birthing process, as you mentioned. I don't know, do you have any thoughts about that, like how the individuals can come together and try and pool resources in that way, and where there might be tension or opportunity there?
Yeah, I also want to have some other things to say besides that, but I think, you know, to start with your question, one of the facts about the 1930s was people could start a cooperative very cheaply. The investment was very small, and there was nothing else you could really do but sort of pool your money and try to move forward. And the cost of living is so much higher now that to form a competitive cooperative just takes massive amounts of capital and much higher level of management, and you're in a much more competitive environment than we had in the 30s, and that's really a tough issue. To me, the more difficult question is really sort of the, Kelly mentioned this too. I mean, the lack of a ethic in America about collaboration is really pretty fierce. So I've worked with two co-ops in the last 5 or 10 years, both of which one man said, I own this co-op, this is my business. And they had formally registered a cooperative, but essentially they wanted to be the decision maker. And that's a real red flag for lots of reasons. But that happens when people try to cut the corners and do what they hope will kind of attract their idealistic energy, but also not really provide the reality of that. The other factor would be like Hmong immigrants, when they first came to this country, you talk about cooperatives, and they're like, nope, I'm not gonna do that, because they were forced into cooperatives in their Laos. And so there's also this kind of, the lack of an ethic and actually resistance that you have in some populations, especially immigrant populations, which also has to be kind of thought about. Tomorrow, the Farmer of the Year, who's gonna talk about his farm, Harold Wilkin, and his son, Ross, they have a collaborative which is privately owned. And that's a very interesting way to kind of finesse these things, where you basically say, okay, Harold and Ross own the business and they have set up a protocol. And last I heard, they had 12 or 15 farmers around them who grew grain to their protocol. But they maintain control of the product, they mill it into flour, and then they realized they needed to do more value added, so they went into baking. I think they found someone to bake bread with their flour. And they're mostly selling, I think, to urban markets. But that's a really good example of being collaborative, where the co-op culture is not there, and getting people to collaborate without insisting on the formal structure. They were busy 24/7 during the pandemic because the Chicago stores didn't have any flour. Not because there was a lack of grain, but because nobody was giving 5-pound bags of flour or 10-pound bags of flour to the mills to deliver to households. It was all 50-pound bags to go to restaurants. So they were shipping flour overnight every hour of the day, because they were the only place you could buy household-ready flour.
Anything else on that concept of just, I don't know, issue areas, potential issue areas?
No, it's okay. So many.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't want to, it's not that we want to hammer on it, but I just wanted to make space if there were other things burning a hole in anyone's pocket.
I think one thing that I've encountered too is that there's a lot of, you know, if the intent is like a formalized co-op, there's a lot of kind of different kinds of understanding in the world about what a co-op is. And so there's, you know, we have people who come, you know, I want to start a co-op, but they think it's a nonprofit, and so then they're going to be eligible for, you know, all these grants and these things, and you're like, well, you know, that's not quite how it's going to work. And so there's like getting clarity on, I also find that like the people who, a lot of people who come forward with a co-op idea, it's like big ideas, like we're going to do these 20 things. And you're like, okay, well, let's pick one and see if your group of 5 to 10 people can like do this thing. And like, let's like hold all these other ideas. Don't forget about them. But, and so like really honing in on like starting small without, you know, losing the bigger dreams, and being clear on like what the co-op model is and isn't. And, you know, I mean, I when groups come to us, I don't consider my job having been done poorly if ultimately people are like, oh yeah, no, this shouldn't be a co-op. Like, this should be another type of business. Or I'm like, great, go forth. Like, you know, I'm glad you came to that conclusion now. and so, yeah, I think that there's you know, it is a, it's a niche, weird business model that we just, you know, we use the word a lot without knowing, like, kind of some, what some of the real, like, specific parameters are around it in the kind of, you know, formal co-op business sense. Yeah, and that just takes, and I think, you know, one of the other things that it depending on where you are, like Ken mentioned, you know, in Wisconsin, Minnesota, we're really fortunate, like, long co-op history, lots of co-ops in these states, great co-op law, like lots of, you know, banking and other financial institutions that know what co-ops are and will deal with co-ops. But there are a lot of parts of the country where they're like, co-what? You know, like, what do you want to do? And, or you can't even actually incorporate a co-op. Like, you have to create a different, even form another business type and then write, like, an operating agreement to essentially be a co-op. And so I do think that there's, you know, there are a lot of places where the kind of, you know, the policy framework and the support framework in terms of financing and all of those things are not there. And it's just harder. I mean, you know, there's people trying to pave the way everywhere, but, you know, we're really lucky here that we have the environment we do.
And co-op lawyers.
Co-op attorneys, co-op accountants. Oh, my God, co-op accounting. Like, oh, it's a whole thing. So
yeah,
there are not enough of them. They all, there's, like, so many co-op accountants retired in the pandemic. I'm like, no, don't. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, oh, yes?
I wanted to throw one more story about Resistance Out, which I think is, it's really one of my favorite co-op stories in the world. But the Wolf Cooperative in Northeast Indiana is a grain a milling cooperative. And when I interviewed them, it was actually owned by an Amish man who owned a private business as a grain miller doing organic grain for a very burgeoning Organic Valley dairy and then confined chicken operations that were organic. And he realized that the growth in his industry was so fast he could not keep up with it. So he went to his Amish neighbors and said, I can't do this, I can't capitalize it. Will you buy me out and we'll form a cooperative? And if you do buy me out, I will run this for 10 years. It was an incredible element of trust and of kind of vision about long-term how to do this. They went from 1.6 million sales to $16 million of sales in 3 years and survived a fire. But one of the resistance points was the Amish at first who said, well, you know, we're not supposed to be aligned with a governmental organization. The cooperative is a legal entity. And one of the elders in the community said, how many of you are shipping milk to Organic Valley? You're part of a cooperative already. And the resistance just melted away. And they all, you know, they also, they had the capital in the community to kind of form this cooperative and make a really exciting growth. And they were helped in that by the Indiana Farm Bureau staff. They're main lobbyists for the state helped them form that cooperative because he saw this as an incredible opportunity to help something good happen. So,
yeah, great story. I'm going to move on to our next question, which is pitching to Austin. And we've heard some from you today about some of these larger structural issues that exist in our world, in our economy. So how do you see cooperatives being uniquely impacted when we look at these larger economic and social forces going on right now?
Yeah, so like 2 points come to mind on that. One is they're not playing on a level field. If anything, they're running uphill. And I see that the most with grocery stores. I had a retailer once described, a grocery store district manager described to me as they increasingly view themselves more and more like a mall. They make their money through slotting fees and less because the margins are so thin on the food, it's almost a wash. Mm-hmm. And so what I mean by that for co-ops is, I mean, I'm learning all this as we speak. I mean, the shenanigans that goes around with placement of items in a store. I mean, even the fact, I know this is news, some people in this room probably already know this, but category captains. So what this is like, for example, like, and I don't know this for a fact, but like take the pork case. What the stores will do is they'll let the largest producer design the case. So you'll have Smithfield, you know, lay out the land. And as anyone knows, like that middle eye is like the sweet spot. Mm-hmm. And so who knows, you could do everything right as a co-op. Who knows if you're even getting placed into that? You could be walled off. It could be really hard to even get that contract. Walmart wants to, you know, they don't want to deal with a supplier who's going to do just one store. So you already have that running uphill, you know, barrier. And the second thing, and this kind of goes back to what Josh was saying earlier of the work component, but also you start mimicking kind of what you're trying to oppose. And the thing, and I'm trying to tread carefully here, when I was doing my dairy chapter, the amount of time the fluid milk co-ops would come up and issues with them was it's one of those things, I didn't think it was part of the chapter, but I kept hearing it from everyone that I really had to dig into it. And Food and Water Watch just came out with a report last month on concentration and dairy, and two fluid milk co-ops, let me back this up, two companies control 77% of the U.S. market on fluid milk, and they are both dairy co-ops. And so you have mission drift at play here. You have, I mean, gotta be careful here with the legal stuff, but you have some of these co-ops acting in against farmers because there is that mentality takes place. And that's a really hard thing of, things can start with good intentions, but they can go off the rails real fast. And again, like you're saying, people are busy. Who has time to know the nuances of bylaws, what's going on, all this professional stuff, until what we've seen in fluid milk is tons of these litigation over price fixing by the co-ops. So that is something, again, with they're mimicking, they're most likely mimicking behavior they're seeing other corporate giants do in this space, where it's kind of like, I call it the envy, you know, like the next door neighbor, well, their corporate office looks like this, we want, you know what I mean? You start, or they get company cars, or the salary, or their executive makes this, and you just start seeing that happen slow. And it doesn't happen overnight. It's usually decades in the making. But that is something I see of these larger forces in America, how they're impacting co-ops.
Yeah, and I want to add one other thought to that, just from the, you know, my time in the Farmers Union, whether it was on the board or on the staff or in the membership. It's come up a lot over the years. Farmers have lost control of some cooperatives that were, they were powerhouses, like for the organization. They developed these businesses, and that business helped feed the organization, helped the organization to do all these things they wanted to do, helped support the farmers, whether it was getting the price point they wanted or accessing things that they needed. And then at some point, people got busy, and they stepped off that board, and someone else stepped up, and they lost control. And soon, those businesses were consolidating and making new choices and moving into new sectors and forgot the farmers. And not that that's a story of every cooperative, but we do have a history of that happening, especially in the agriculture sector, where there's just a finite amount of energy, right? And so I appreciate you bringing that up, because I think sometimes we're trying to bring in expertise onto that board, or we're trying to, you know, make space for ourselves to live a farming life, and we lose control of the thing that we were counting on. So just a thought that I had. But anyone else want to add to that as well?
I can add, but some other people first.
So I would say that while the, you know, Ken was reporting on the farm crisis and doing all that work, my family was sitting around the dinner table talking about the reality of that farm crisis, where my dad was trying to get into farming in the mid-80s, and my grandfather was talking him out of it. Part of that conversation was around the co-ops that were consolidating in the neighborhood. And I think that same pattern is now happening in the grocery sector of cooperatives. It's happening in the dairy, fluid dairy. And so I think we all kind of have, as farmers, I really feel like conventional, organic, whatever your stripe, you kind of look at it with a lot of skepticism. Like, it's just going to replicate exactly what is already out there. And if the only motivation is money, then that's just the bottom line. You're not gonna see the benefit of it. You're just gonna put up work. So
yeah, so staying to that mission.
Right. Yeah, part of the mission.
And I think the thing that's hard is that, like, these co-ops, you know, that started small and, you know, very, you know, farmer driven, like they are trying to exist in this marketplace with these corporations that are driving things in certain directions, right? And the only, and in some ways, I'm not like absolving them of, you know, whatever for having drifted, but it's like, in order to stay competitive, your point, you know, like they haven't been immune to the forces in the, you know, conventional dairy and other economies, right? And so, and I think that, I mean, co-ops are, they're microcosms of a democracy, right? And so, like, when things are going well, like, the members are not, you know, somewhat disengaged. They're like, it's going great. Like, I'm getting the price I want. I'm getting a dividend at the end of the year. You know, and it's like only when stuff starts to shift that you start, you know, people start to like pay attention. And so I think that things have like gone too far and it's like hard to get control back. And so I think that when people are thinking about, when I talked about people who are starting co-ops that are never going to be, you know, the big, you know, dairy co-ops of the world, these are not going to be that big ever. But the conversation is around what are the ways in which you like engage members all the time, not just through the economic transaction with the co-op, but what kind of communication is there? What kind of empowerment is there for them to be involved in, you know, on a committee or on the board or whatever, so that there's higher level of participation in the democracy? Because like, if you don't participate in the democracy, if you don't show up for the annual meeting, you don't vote for the people running for the board, like it's hard, you know, that's what happens. And it's that's a somewhat of a simplification, but like then people, you know, realize like this has gone off the rails and I'm like paying attention and I feel like I don't have any power. And so when I'm working with groups again much smaller, it's like and it's never gonna be perfect. You're never gonna have like 100% of your members showing up and voting and all of the things, but how do you keep people engaged so that they can be, you know, part of this, the democratic process that makes a co-op and helps it stay closer to like, you know, the mission, the values, et cetera.
Yeah, I think I want to take this question from a slightly different angle, which is I worked with the Berry Center on their cooperative home place meets to try to do a well-branded, Wendell Berry approved, rose veal, what they call kind of basically young animals that they're calling veal, but they're trying to avoid the sort of specter of white veal, so they call it rose veal. But a lot of the Berry Center's motivation is that Wendell Berry's father helped start tobacco cooperatives back in the 20s and 30s. And at that time, things were so fluid that those farmers could, there was tobacco cultivation in this part of Wisconsin all the way down to Kentucky and further east, probably in the Carolinas. They could spread word of mouth and get about 80% of the tobacco production under their cooperative. So they had incredible market power. You can't do that with grass-fed beef in Kentucky right now. And so there's this hope of doing a cooperative, but you have to really reach out to very small niche markets in high-end restaurants. The neighbors of these farmers really don't think they can afford the meat. And you can't really command market share. You can only build sort of very specific niche loyalties. So, also it was started by a nonprofit that could raise money to start a cooperative. So there's this whole dynamic of it starting with someone else's money, and the farmers are kind of happy to get a better price, but it's not really the kind of classic cooperative that the Berries were hoping it would be.
I will say, let me tell you about a co-op I do love. I love my credit union. When I first opened my bank account, it was a little Iowa bank, not little, Des Moines-based bank called Ben Bank. But guess what? It was eventually bought out by Wells Fargo. And what I noticed as a customer is how much that service just got awful. I remember what did me in was I went in to get something done with a personal banker, and the personal banker couldn't do anything. They had to call a hotline. So it's like, why am I sitting in this office with you when you have to call 1-800 number? And also, this company doesn't even trust you to make a decision as a professional. After that, I moved my stuff over to a credit union. I adore my credit union. First of all, my battle rates are great. But also, it's just people are happier there. It's so rare anymore in America to have people doing jobs consumer-facing jobs that they just love. These places are nice. It's locally owned. I know they're not donating to political stuff. It's just nice to kind of have something simple and rooted in my community.
Good.
All right. Oh, did you have something you wanted to add? Okay. So those were the pre-prepared questions. So I hope that you have all been listening with an ear toward, what do I want to know about co-ops? Praise goes to the first person to raise their hand with their cooperative question. There we go. We got one. I'm going to carry this back to you so it gets recorded.
Hi there. How do you... I work for the Oneota Community Co-op, the food co-op in Decorah, Iowa. How do you... as co-ops, we've been around 49 years, right? How do you keep things fresh and keep member owners engaged in something like that for 50 years? Because I make business decisions every day as a grocery manager to better them, but I don't feel like I guess, I don't know how to communicate to them or how to keep it fresh that we're doing this so we can stay open. You know, like prices have to increase. We got to do different things. I have to work with NCG. I don't know if there's any other co-op people here. No? Okay. Anyway, I don't know if you have any insight into just how to keep the members engaged after so long. Thank you.
Grocery co-ops are hard, especially when they're really established. They have a big, wide swath of membership. I don't do a ton of work with grocery co-ops. I think some of it, if I can apply some stuff with other types of co-ops, I do. I think some of it is at the point someone becomes a member, like what does that transaction look like and that communication look like? I think that there's so many not so much in grocery, but I have, you know, there are definitely a lot of co-ops that are moving away from the term member. And they're like, you're not signing up to be a member of a club. Like you are becoming one small owner in this business. And so they're making sure like that's the terminal, the wording around when people join. Grocery co-ops are hard. They're a weird nut. Do you guys go to do you have folks at CCMA, the grocery co-op conference? That it's a world of issues. Center, my colleague Megan, it's the National Conference for Grocery Co-ops, and we put it together, and yeah, grocery co-ops are a weird nut, but.
This is kind of a random, I'll come full circle in a second, but so my first job when I was little was a paper boy, got at 12, and I've always read the paper with my parents in the morning growing up, and I loved reading the Sunday ads. It's just something my dad, my mom, and I would sit on the couch, pass the ads back and forth. And to this day, I still go to Target on Friday and look at the new ad. I just enjoy that. As a son of a dad, my dad used to do merchandising for beer, so I always enjoy that kind of game. I say that because I think one of the best ads right now is the Trader Joe's Fearless Flyer. And here's the thing. That thing is not communicating price to you. What they're selling you is a story and a sense of adventure. And I think what, I love your co-op. Part of my family is from Highlandville. So we go up to that neck of the woods. Is so much of the big box stores, it's just the same stuff. And there's nothing new, there's no merchandising. What I love about going to a co-op, food co-ops, is the sense of adventure. I don't know what I'm gonna find. And communicating, check out this new thing. I don't know, that to me is, it makes it fun. That's when you read the Trader Joe's flyer, it's always like, check out this funky dunky thing we have. You read the story, you buy it, you see if you like it, what have you. But, you know, it's a way to kind of live on the edge for $3 and you buy something new.
I just kind of want to, I have a little bit of co-op or grocery co-op experience. I've been selling, I sell honey to co-ops in the Twin Cities, and I've seen them change dramatically since I started selling there 10 years ago. And one of the things I've noticed is they stopped putting as much effort in the stories and supporting the farmers, and they got distracted by what is, I think, a big elephant in this room, is that like our economic system in this country is so out of whack that the model is really struggling to survive against those pressures. And so we're all just like picking our brains on the best way for us to cooperate underneath a very oppressive system. So let's go easy on ourselves, I think. Another thing that I noticed, because my partner still works in food co-ops, all of the co-ops in the Twin Cities started unionizing around the same time, and it was because they stopped really listening to what the workers were trying to tell the management and the board. And I see this a lot with other co-ops where there is way too big of a disconnect between the people that are front-facing and doing the really hard work of that interfacing with customers and cleaning and running those departments, and then who makes those decisions based on those economic pressures. So it's complicated, but those are things that I've noticed.
Now we've got the questions flowing.
I just want to piggyback on what Christy said. I think something to roll over from the discussion from Austin's session I mean, cooperatives are trying to survive in an environment that punishes the operation that doesn't externalize all its costs onto the environment, livestock, farmers, farm workers, customers. And at some point here, I think we need to speak to whether capitalism is the water that cooperatives must swim in. And if you want to return the costs back onto the agribusiness balance sheets, which would basically end them, we have to kind of reject the present context as if it's the natural order of things. Just a comment.
Amen.
Does anyone want to respond to that?
Well, yeah, let me try that. I had the luxury of going to Italy for 2 weeks of a co-op development course in Bologna in 2006. And what was really interesting about that was the Italian government forces cooperatives to build savings accounts. They're required to put a certain amount of their revenue into a pool of money so they can do acquisitions and they can have stability for their workers and all that stuff. And essentially, the Italian government subsidizes cooperatives the way our government subsidizes private firms. And that means it's a very vibrant sector. And you have world-class manufacturers in Bologna and in that whole region of Italy who are exporting, you know, high-quality tea bags, high-quality metal working materials, and they have phenomenal reach globally. They have phenomenally high tech positions. But it's also a matter of state subsidy and the state saying this is a priority to have cooperation. And that's, of course, a post-World War II socialist communist leadership structure saying we have to do this to be competitive in a global economy. And I think that underscores your point pretty well.
All right, we've got another question over here, and people will have to raise their hand again for me because I lost track of who you all are.
What about just being more local? So like to piggyback on your banking story, like I know my loan officer because her husband goes to the same gym as my partner, so she knows me by my first name. But that's a Corp C bank with 5 branches in 2 counties. So I wonder if some of this is just we need to be hyper-local. And I wondered what the panel thought about that.
I think there are some sectors where that would work. I think that there are some, you know, in sectors where there's like a certain amount of regulation and a certain amount, you know, I think like there's, you know, with banks, like there's like a scale involved with like getting all these kind of federally backed, you know, loan programs and things like that. I think there's economies of scale, like, right, that make it hard to be hyperlocal. I think in the worker co-op space, which, you know, gets you out, you know, not necessarily in ag, I mean, you know, a group of painters, a group of roofers, a group of whatever, like there's a lot of opportunity to be hyperlocal. And I think my colleague at the center, Charity, who does a lot of the worker co-op development stuff in the city of Madison, a lot of those worker co-ops are like they're small, like they're never going to get more than between like 5 to 10 people, and they're doing very localized work, and you know, under a co-op structure. And I do think that there are that kind, it can really work, but I think that there are certain industries that are, it's harder to just go hyper local.
I'm personally moving away. I mean, I try to live that philosophy, but I'm personally moving away from the notion that personal individual consumption can drive structural change. I mean, I say this out of all respect. I think that Michael Pollan framework of, oh, use your fork, the system got worse since Omnivore's Dilemma came out. I mean, you look at Whole Foods, who owns Whole Foods? I don't know if he's second richest, third richest in the world, what have you. But it's just one of those, power just consolidates, power compounds power. And I'm also, most people are just trying to get by. And so, like, yeah, they want to do, Walmart, I mean, that's the hardest I'm having right now writing this chapter in Walmart. They have the lowest grocery prices. And it's really hard to tell people that their individual behavior is worse for the collective. But that's what's going on here. It creates, this family has this flywheel that's just going like this. But it's almost like a waterbed where, sure, they have the lower prices, but what it means for is that food co-op that's trying to buy the same thing, well, then the supplier's charging them more to make up for what they're losing from Walmart, because Walmart is squeezing them. it's not like a, I don't know, it took me forever. I had this thing that I really fought, and it's an old law that we kind of forgot in America called the Robinson-Patman Act, where it's, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm gotta be careful here, where it's basically producers could set price floors. You cannot sell a product below a certain thing. And for a long time, I actually personally didn't like that, because like in my head, I was like, well, if I go to Costco, if I buy more, I should get a discount. And that rule banned it. Here's the thing. I'm one person. When Walmart, like when a company's that big, they just have so much more power. And what you're trying to do is that co-op wholesaler in Walmart, you're trying to keep that competitive. Because if you don't, what happens is it's just the scales keep tipping and tipping and tipping. And so what you're actually seeing right now is, and it sounds so weird. Keep an eye on right now what's going on with the FTC and Pepsi and Coke. They're investigating this behavior going on in grocery stores. And they're trying to bring back this dead law and make it alive again. So to kind of set that price floor. So that way, it's not this race to the bottom. Who can squeeze the labor the most? And instead, can we actually compete on service? And like have, I mean, that's why certain suppliers won't even get into Walmart. Because once you get into that world, they make you open your books. They will tell you who to fire. They are, but it's Walmart. Because you're never more than 1% of their sales. But trust me, you will quickly become 34, 40% of your sales will go to them. And that is such an like awful power balance to be in. It's kind of incredible to watch what's happened in America in 40 years where Procter & Gamble used to call the conversation. And now they're at the mercy of this family in Northwest Arkansas.
All right, we've got 3 more questions I see lined up.
Thanks for this discussion, Wally over here. I was a past board chair of a grocery co-op down in Lincoln, Nebraska. And typically when we talked about milk or sweet potatoes and why we're not buying local was that the distributor price that they got was higher than the local competitor. So what they're paying from their distributor is actually more expensive than the retail price of Natural Grocers, good old TJ's, which I do enjoy the frequent flyer, or the flyer. And I feel that information, if told to the consumer member owner, as you wish the label, is part of Principle 5, which is education, training, and information. So if you could talk a little bit about what do you feel is missing in the education piece on Principle 5 for the co-ops that you are familiar with, and what do you wish we did better on education?
I think the Austin hit on a really important point, which is that the desire to be showing new products. Yeah. The Twin Cities co-ops all started in low-income communities because there was cheap rent, and there was a lot of rhetoric about we're going to bring bulk foods, they'll be less expensive, and we'll be able to help low-income people get better food. And that educational process did not work out very well because low-income people didn't feel like they belonged in the store. And they, if culturally it was a clash, and even though the prices were good and the foods were healthy, I don't want to be there. And I think that the result of that, the Twin Cities, our co-ops have sort of morphed towards we want to be the place where people who have a lot of money come to find out what's innovative in food. And that's the answer to your question about how do we kind of keep that attractive going. And I'm a member of one co-op in Minneapolis. It looks a lot like a Whole Foods store. And I really don't like to shop there that much, but it's close to my house. And I joined, but I'm also going to a different co-op that I feel more at home in. I also wanted to kind of respond to that in terms of a community process, which is quite valuable for a hyper-local cooperative in Mount Pulaski, Illinois. This is a really wonderful co-op that started in the pandemic. It was a store that opened up in the middle of the pandemic when we were not going to stores and all that stuff. But it happened because actually a whole complex set of arrangements, which really is about, in my view, a community food web in a very exciting way, where the folks in town recognized that if they didn't have a grocery store, nobody would have a place to meet. So the reason for having a store was a gathering point. And then there were farmers who had land that they would lease out to a young farmer to start a 5-acre farm to grow vegetables. And then they said, we need a place to buy those vegetables. So the combination of all that allowed this little town of, I think, 400 people or something to start. They had an empty storefront right in the downtown square. And in a place that doesn't have a lot of co-op culture, they opened a cooperative grocery store in the middle of the pandemic because it met all those criteria. The other part of the story, though, is that they could do that because 5 years before, a Brazilian or Italian wind firm came into the community and wanted to site windmills. And a farmer on the board of the Economic Development Association said, we're happy to have you site your windmills, but you got to pay us $200,000 to locate your windmills and $100,000 a year for operating from here on. So the town had a slush fund that they built up by taxing this windmill company. They could apply their own economic development. So we had this incredibly thoughtful process of a farmer with a vision, with land leasing to a young farmer, and then people coming together and said, we can put capital together to start this store. And so that, you know, to me, that's a collaboration that's community-wide. It's really not about, it's a formal cooperative, but it's a much richer story than that, too. They're getting a lot of press right now in Illinois. Suddenly, it's become a really big story in the public radio. So, you know, it's now 3 years later, but.
Yeah, it's kind of a question prefaced by a comment. This comes from my own personal co-op experience, and Kelly actually did a survey of the cooperative that I work for, Central Plains Organic Farmers Association, which is a producer, farmer-producer co-op located in Kansas and Nebraska. And one of the things, I joined it in the late 70s, and then we chartered in 92, and we continue to go. And, you know, we sell a lot of grain. But what we found is our loyalty is very thin. Mm. We consider it really good. And I functioned as a marketer. I've worked for him officially for about 19 years. And as a marketer, if I could capture 50% of product, and we never even discussed pools, which pools are a really integral part of producer co-ops, if you're willing to commit, pool your acres. Well, I had this unique experience of Peace Corps service, and Peace Corps placed me in a Mayan village in southern Belize, and it had a unique thing in that it had no land. They did not own the land. They were squatting on some crown land or something in the rainforest. And so they just used traditional land tenure. And everyone was farming about 4 to 6 acres. And so there was an organic cacao cooperative that had been formed. And the Peace Corps was tasked with, let's increase the membership and the production and everything like that. I got to tell you, the loyalty and the adherence to the co-op was just incredible. And it was because, I can't figure out, is it because of the tribal mindset, or was it the leveled financial and personal situation where everybody was the same and they needed each other? There was no way they could produce enough that they could ever enter a marketplace. And so they had to do that. And when I think back of, I farmed in Kansas and lived there like 50 years, the little rural communities, and I'm sure it's Iowa and Wisconsin too, they had a relatively leveled income level in communities. I mean, it mm-hmm. wasn't a big difference. Mm-hmm. And they had that community need. And you look at the way it is now, I mean, in rural communities, there's an income inequality that has developed over the last 50 years that's incredible.
Yep.
Do you think is that the stopper for a really vibrant cooperative that, I mean, people that will give themselves to? Or is there a new cooperative model that could exist in this unequal scenario?
Well, you probably know, Kelly may know more about this than I do, but I would say, first of all, I don't think people of high means ever want to be in a cooperative if they don't have to. You know, they're mobile, they have money, they can make motions. The Fifth Season Co-op here in Viroqua had several farmers who cut out of the cooperative because they thought they could make more money elsewhere. And over time, they came back in because they realized that they were, getting a good price for a while, but it faded away. So you had, I think, some growers who left and came back. So that was a good sign. But that's also a very strong local cooperative culture, which most places don't have. In Belize, I can well imagine that there's sort of a assumption of village decision making that's pretty democratic, and people are pretty much there together and understand that they need to take care of each other, which is pretty much lacking in most of America right now. But I can still see less privileged people joining forces despite to work with each other at a lower level, at a lower income level, just kind of letting the other people go. But that's hard to pull off. I'm sorry.
No, I think, there's, when I think about one of the differences, like one of the things that makes some consumer co-ops so hard, like a grocery co-op or what is that, like people, the consumer owners of that entity are not relying on that entity for their livelihood, right? Like it's a thing that gets them some stuff that they want, right? But that's not their livelihood. And so I feel like, but at the same time, having worked what Harry mentioned, like having worked with CPOFA and their kind of umbrella co-op OFARM, like even in this situation where you have these organic grain co-ops that are, they are providing a pretty significant livelihood for these producers without the constant reminder about what the co-op is and what it does for you, you can still get people who are like, well, if I can get a better price elsewhere, like, so whatever, I'll go because that's what I'm, what I'm driven by, as opposed to like the co-op structure or something else. And so, there's not a perfect solution, but I think some of it is like asking membership, like, what is it that you want to know about us? And then figuring out the format in which they want to receive that information. Is it, and again, if you've got a big diverse membership, like in a grocery co-op, that's hard. But, there were some ideas that were coming out of the OFARM conversations about these folks are used to getting a summary of, text every week with different kinds of information. Could we do that? And then that reminds them who we are, why we're here, what we do for them. It's hard. It's hard to be, back to this issue of we're all just on this treadmill of trying to make enough money, and there's this oppressive system and no one has enough money or enough time. But that I think co-ops that commit, it doesn't have to be large volumes of education or information, but make an ongoing commitment in little ways all the time to have that education touch, that information touch with the membership, it does make a difference to and you won't reach everybody, but it's the same way, we're in, and you think about in the political sphere and the political democracy, we're inundated with ads and calls and, all the things. And it's what are the ways that are going to grab enough people's attention who are in your membership, that it's not, that's not cost prohibitive or time prohibitive. And it will be different for every co-op, what that looks like. But having a commitment to that, and that one of the things that does, I mean, I think that when I think about burnout in all senses, but certainly in co-ops, there's, and then, how you end up having so much, co-ops that drift, and if you are not constantly, the blessing and the curse of co-ops is that those member owners have to, get in the position to run for the board. If no one runs for the board, or it's the same people running for the board, or that, they drift from, and they have a lot of non-members on the board, things like that, you have to be cultivating leadership from within your membership to keep it rooted in whatever it was about. And one of the ways you do that is through whatever that member education looks like, member information looks like. If those folks, don't even know it's a co-op, they don't, it's hard to bring people through the ranks to eventually run for the board and participate in bigger ways. And I mean, that's a struggle of every co-op everywhere, is how do we cultivate people to be on the board and be in leadership and do this work. But
I will say, to me, the silver lining here too is what I see is, I think we're near the end of this hyper-individualistic era. Yeah. No, no. So here's why. I mean, there is. This is okay. This
he
is
where
the silver
near,
lining.
He didn't say at.
There's no such thing as a soft landing by the Federal Reserve. I don't think we as a country have grappled with the trickle-down monetary policy we've engaged in for the last 10, 15 years. When you keep interest rates that low, it's not benefiting millennials trying to buy homes or farmland. It's benefiting people with assets already. And that bubble's bursting in front of us as they yank up rates to get inflation under control. I mean, you look at farmland prices in Iowa, and it's like, that doesn't, I mean, come on. It doesn't make sense. The years earlier you mentioned, the decades where there were successive co-ops, were these moments where we had these financial moments in American history. Is where people realize, like, it's easy to be hyper-individualistic when it's 3% unemployment. And I understand that 3% figure is masking a lot, but I think it's going to, the next few years in America are going to be really interesting to watch, because basically Congress has stopped working from 2010 and the Federal Reserve is now driving the conversation. You can stimulate economy two different ways. Congress can spend money or you can print money. And I know they print, I mean, we talked about all those COVID checks came out of Congress. The Fed spent billion, trillion, way more money than that. And that's the problem here. It's so hard to understand. That's where you see people profit off of. But that's why I see this hyper-individualistic era coming to a close. It's just, I see a lot of people living beyond their means. It's a very self-centered, like, there's a self-centeredness that really hit our culture. I mean, I personally think, like, social media is a huge component of this. I mean, we went from a culture where a print newspaper had to sell to the middle, had to sell to both sides, and it created community. Oh, get to know this new restaurant that opened, get to know the blank. And now we're living in these tech billionaires who created these rage machines that destroy community. But this is, people are sick of it. It's coming to a close. And one of the most bipartisan things in America right now is everyone thinks the system's rigged. And so that's where I see, and I know it's weird to use the phrase silver lining here, it's just gilded ages always come to a close. And usually the last gilded age in America produced a big reform movement that was really good for the co-op space. So I don't know if that's hopeful or dark or what have you. But
I just don't buy it. I mean,
yeah.
No,
I mean, if you but if you read the Wall Street Journal right now, it's kind of scary. China's going through a property bubble that was way worse than ours. It is like you're having people are buying trucks they cannot afford. These trucks are leaving their lots are $67,000. Their incomes didn't go up. People are buying second, third homes, and you're just like, the thing that gets me is Phoenix is the fastest growing city in America, and you're like, there's no water.
You know, you mentioned earlier about, what was it, moving ethanol or moving gas and putting it in the ground and then fracking it. So that doesn't sound to me like that's going to change, you know, like they're just going to find another way for that money to stay in that 1%.
They get too greedy. The smartest monopoly is the one that just has a monopoly and prices it just above the competitive price. Cargill's a really smart monopoly. You know what I mean? Like, they're the largest private company in America, maybe since the 1960s. There is one book by a Canadian written on them. When have you seen a story on them? Yes, sorry.
I'm sorry, we have 10 minutes left and I have two more questions lined up. So I want to be respectful of everyone's time. But I would love to debate this in the hallway afterwards for a very long time this evening. Yes, one more.
One of two.
Thank you. First, I got to disagree with something, and then I have a question. I've done price checking on Walmart and on Sam's Club, and so you know, like, you can buy cheaper food at Walmart if you want to be nutritionally deprived and probably end up ill, but if you want to buy real food at Walmart, it's often more expensive, and when you go to Sam's Club and get a bigger package, it's often more expensive than getting two smaller packages other places. You know, by the unit, they don't actually win. They've just tricked you regularly to do that. My question is back on the cooperative topic. You know, we have a co-op, a food co-op in Stevens Point that isn't really struggling, and largely because it's avoided just by being just barely not big enough, the fact that there are intentional predators in the co-op world that have gone into every co-op that has grown and basically convinced or extorted or whatever all the co-ops to change their bylaws, to weaken democratic control, to enter into agreements that move the power outside of the membership up to like another level of association that is that where the seats on the board are employees and not actually even member owners of the underlying. And so for a couple of you who work directly with co-ops, do you do any work to basically at the startup or at any phase inform people doing, you know, building new co-ops that essentially if they grow, this is going to happen to them? I mean, you can find online the criteria that consultant groups use to identify co-ops that are ready for them to come in. It's like management change. That means they're at risk. Let's go in and help them. And then every single time, what that help looks like is bylaws changing to reduce democratic control and them signing on to contracts with organizations bigger than them that essentially take the decision-making out of the hands. And so this is an obvious threat. It's been around now for the entire time I've been alive. It's happened to basically every food co-op that's bigger than mine, and it's happened to the dairy co-ops. You know, I show up, I'm an attorney, I show up at a meeting of dairy co-op members, and I ask them to see the bylaws, and the bylaws say the board of directors can change the bylaws by an affirmative vote of the majority, and I'm like, okay, you're screwed, right? I don't know who missed this when however many years ago you allowed your board to be able to completely change the rules of your organization, but is there anything you're doing to warn or educate people who are coming to you in your expert positions that people are going to come and propose this and they're going to leverage the financial resources that they're going to offer and they're going to come with their expertise and their degrees and tell you to do this, but this is the demise. So, wow. Yeah, what do you say to them to prep them for that?
Well, first, I just want to say you're correct on the price. I mean, I'm repeating a narrative we all hear in Walmart, and it's funny you say that. Someone, I just assume Walmart always has the lowest price. So actually, my way back to Iowa, I have a whole roadmap of I want to do, what I've been told from people is Walmart price, they have different prices depending on the market. So if they're in La Crosse, because it's a competitive grocery market, the prices are going to be different than Viroqua. So literally, my way back to Iowa, my plan is to kind of buy the same five items and just see. Because like, I'm just assuming the narrative's correct. And that's so much what we have to do is challenge the conventional narrative of what these companies say. Just because they asserted doesn't mean they're right. So I just want to say, yeah. My apology on that point.
All right. Oh, go ahead.
I mean, I think one of the things that I think that there's some interesting, for a long time, there's a particular governance model that has been dominant in the co-op community. We call it, it's whether you do it all the way or part of the way, but people talk about policy governance. So basically, your elected boards of directors creates policy that the manager, management team, whatever, implements, and that's how that informs the operation of the business. And I think one of the things, to your point, Oren, like, there's definitely a lot of, I have a lot of groups now who are interested in really different governance models, and those governance models inform the bylaws, right? So it's like at the bylaw level, you're creating a document that supports, and this is like gonna get wonky, but supports a like not concentrating power in the board, but also not concentrating power in like one manager for either, right? So having, you know, whether you call it a management team, management circles, or there's not, you know, you it's there's structure, but it's like a little bit more flat. A lot of the co-ops, like I personally don't work with a lot of grocery co-ops or any, but the in the like a smaller co-op space, there's interest in different kind, you know, moving away from that that policy governance that gets funneled through a manager. And so that, like, when I'm working with groups in formation, it's like, what are those structures that feel right to you there that don't hinge on that like single manager person that ends up with some of the scenarios like you're talking about.
And we're down to 5 minutes left. So I'm going to ask each of our panelists to just give us a little nugget before we leave. And I do hope that everybody who's been in this room has had some new ideas pop up, right? Some different ways of thinking about things, some different questions. And we can continue this conversation all throughout this conference by running into each other or by following up afterwards. But I want each of our panelists to give us, in a sentence, we're going to go with a sentence. I know, it's hard. I like to create a challenge. Just one thing that you think anyone who's interested in cooperatives should know should have in their pocket as they go forward. And you can have a minute to think about it because we have 5 whole minutes left and there are 4 of you.
I would say find one you really admire what you're trying to do and just study the heck out of it. Call people up. Just see what they did right. You don't need to reinvent the wheel here.
One sentence.
Well, you know, the thing I would want to say in one sentence is a little bit off your question, but despite all the complications of this, at last I heard 10% of the grocery co-ops in the U.S. were in Minnesota. Huh. And there's, you know, there's still an amazing robustness, and I'm feeling a lot of small towns turning to cooperatives in this tough time, and the pandemic really did push people's awareness of we've got to collaborate in different ways and be more inclusive. So that's hopeful for me.
And I think as farmers, we have to not get hung up on how much of a cooperative we're doing and how cooperative-y cooperatives are. because we really are, like, just doing the basic production and feeding the community that you live in is really enough, and it has to be enough, and you can't burn out. I mean, we need people doing this work, and if you push too hard, you will want to stop. You don't want to stop.
This might not be where, this is very different than, any chance you get to take a class on facilitation or how to run a good meeting. Like, the number of people I know who won't run for co-op boards because they're like, our board meetings are however many hours long. No, I mean, the art of running a good meeting, I mean, that will serve you for the rest of your life in like anything that you do. But, and some amount of like, yeah, facilitating group conversation, and that's connected to the meeting thing, but yeah. Do it.
So I heard, be hopeful. I heard, don't burn yourself out. I heard,
study success.
Study, yeah, learn. And I also heard study, but with an emphasis on soft skills.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because there are people who can help you with the hard stuff, right?
Right. Co-ops are not just made and broken with the business plan and the spreadsheets, but with people pulling their hair out in meetings.
Yeah. Well, I want to be respectful of everyone's time and everywhere you might need to go after this. So thank you all for coming. And and helping this be a really great conversation. And one other thing that I just realized I should mention, if you have young people in your life and you happen to live in a state like Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Farmers Union has a camp called Camp Kenwood, and they focus on teaching you some of these skills around cooperatives. And if that is something appealing to the people in your life, you might share with them that that exists, because we do have to start early to work on all these big projects. But thank you all. Have a great conference, and we'll see you around.